probably doing what your wife is doing, packing up to take places.
I feel bad. We have friends who have nowhere to go. They're sitting there in their hot houses with nothing to do. And we're lucky we have family to go to in the area. Yeah.
A few years ago, the same thing happened, and we had power, and people bought stuff in Naples.
Okay, so we'll start. Before we start, I wanted to share just our conversation about the weather. I just a brief thought about the weather that we had recently. It's very interesting. In the Shemona Esrei prayer, so you get the first, every blessing has a different name. If you look in the sources for the blessing, each blessing has its own name. So the first one's referred to as Avos, the blessing of the patriarchs. We talk about, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. The second one's called Gevuros, the blessing of power and strength. The third blessing was called Kedusha, it's the blessing of holiness, sanctity. So the Gemara says that we mention God's power over weather in the bracha called Gevuros, the bracha of strength, power. The insert we say, Mashiv HaRuach Mered HaGeshem, that Hashem causes the wind to blow and the rain to fall. Right, that's in the blessing of Gevuros, of power, of strength. And it's called, you mentioned the Gevuros Geshem, you mentioned the power of the rain. That's what how the Gemara describes that insert, that blessing. So I was thinking about it, in light of the storm, and by the way, in the past I thought about it also. I think the one thing in the world which we're totally helpless against, where we really see God's sheer strength, is the weather. Even when it comes to medicine, we have so many ways that we can deal with, fight, you know, prolong life, and heal. Every single other area of life, you know, we have some way, something we can do to protect ourselves. When it comes to the weather, you take cover and you pray. There's nothing else you can do because you're seeing God's sheer strength. It's totally out of our hands. The most wealthy country, the weakest country, the most intelligent people, the least intelligent people, no one has nothing to do about it. You just sit back and you trust that God will take care of you, and you let God display His strength. So the fact that the rabbis described that the blessing that refers to weather fits into the blessing of strength, I think makes a lot of sense. As watching the storm, I was thinking about this, you know, Friday night. And I thought about it in the past with hurricanes, other weather events we've had around here, you know, in recent years. But that's the rabbis say. During the winter months, we mention the rain and the blessing of Gevuros, of strength. That's called Mizkir and Gevuros Geshamim. I mean, God makes the wind blow and the rains fall. So just a side point about weather, but I guess it's a very pertinent message this week. So if you get back to our regularly scheduled
topic. Thank you,
topic,
appreciate that.
Sure,
thank
no problem.
What did he say about air conditioning?
It's a good question, too. Right. Get back to our regularly scheduled topic. We are in the middle of discussing some laws in the Parsha of Mishpatim, which mostly deals with, you know, financial law and laws which we said are more intellectual, more rational laws. Someone discussed two mitzvos in Mishpatim. And then with the time we have left, I want to introduce the mourning period of the next 3 weeks, the fast of the 70th of Tammuz, and so on. So just to stick with our regular topic first, we are up to discussing an interesting area of halacha, which is the four different types of watchmen.
Shomrim. Four different types of what?
Watchmen. Guardians, or watchmen. Understanding it, it's important to understand halachically how we view these different areas of financial law, understanding God's true perspective on financial law. So you have halachically four different types of guardians or watchmen over property. Well, let's list the four, and we'll discuss the differences briefly.
Go ahead.
Okay, no problem. The first one is called a shomer chinam, which is an unpaid watchman. Someone's doing you a favor. The second one is called a shomer sachar, which is a paid watchman. So you say, you know, if you watch my, keep an eye on my bag for an hour, I'll give you $15. That'd be a paid watchman. The third type of watchman would be someone who borrows your item. They also have responsibilities in guarding your item, a borrower.
Is that a shomer something?
It's called a shoel.
Shoel.
And the fourth type is called a socher, which is a renter. So all four of these different people have responsibilities vis-a-vis your item, but they have different liability. This is taking on each one individually. So the first one we mentioned is the shomer chinam, the unpaid watchman. So the unpaid watchman, he has to fulfill his duty in guarding your item. But if something happens to it, he is exempt from payment unless he was negligent. So if he's watching your item as he's supposed to be, and somebody comes and steals it, or he's watching as he's supposed to be, and there's an inexplicable loss, or it rains on it, or whatever it is, an animal comes by and stomps on it, he wasn't able to stop the animal. He's exempt from paying, because he wasn't paid in the first place. What he's doing you a favor. he's less level of liability halachically, unless he's negligent. He's responsible for negligence. So if he walks away and doesn't watch it, if he's stupid with it, then he has to pay for it. Besides that, he's exempt from paying. The second category is called a shomer sachar, that's the paid watchman. And for him, we distinguish between different types of loss and damage. For the paid watchman, if the item is lost or stolen, he's exempt from paying. We look at that as something which is somewhat beyond his control, and therefore he's exempt from paying. If the item is broken, or if it's an animal and the animal dies under his watch, or it's captured, let's say it's captured by an army, something like that, so then he's liable to pay for that. That's considered something more of his control, which he should have been able to deal with. The third category is the borrower. The borrower, since he has full rights to use the item, but yet hasn't taken any responsibility monetarily, you're doing him a favor by lending him your item. Therefore, he is the most liable. So for him, he's responsible to pay for any type of loss unless the item breaks during normal usage. I mean, so the classic case in the Gemara is you're borrowing an animal. And the animal, you know, the ox was basically like their tractor, and it was farming equipment. The ox would pull the plow. So the ox is doing its normal everyday work that's expected to do, and it dies. And it wasn't that you took it out in extreme weather, and you didn't put it into an extreme situation. It was doing its normal everyday work, and it died. You're not responsible for that, because that's nothing to do with you. That was just the animal. The animal's time had come, basically. So he's exempt from paying for that animal. But for any other loss, whether it be theft, whether it be it was lost, whether it be you were negligent, whatever the loss is, then the shoel, the borrower, is obligated to pay. And the fourth category, the renter. So the renter is kind of, you know, a middle ground. Because on one hand, the renter has the rights to use the item. On the other hand, they're paying for it. And you're making profit off the renter. So the renter, it's actually a dispute exactly what the status of a renter is. But according to the most opinions, the renter would have the same status as the paid watchman. So they'd be liable, they'd be exempt from paying for theft or loss, but they'd be liable to pay for the undue death of the animal, or if there's a damage or injury which is done on his watch, etc., he's liable to pay for that. So that there's a lot of more details to go into in terms of those four categories, but just, again, it's important to be aware of these categories in halacha. And it does come up occasionally. Your friend will say, can you watch this for me, or can I stick this in your house when we're on vacation, or can you keep an eye on my item while I run into the store? Things can happen like that. So to understand what the Torah would say about the situation is an important thing. We've all borrowed items in our lifetime. We've rented items in our lifetime, so these ideas do come up. The next myth I want to discuss is a little bit more difficult. This does not fit into the realm of rational mitzvahs per se, and like we were discussing until now, mishpatim. This might is something which is a little harder for us to understand. We're not as familiar with in daily life. Make more room. And this is the idea of the Hebrew word is kishuf, which is translated loosely, it's called as witchcraft or magic. I hate using those terms in English because they have a much different connotation in English than in Hebrew. You hear the word term witchcraft, you think about some lady with her pot stewing up frog's legs or something and flying on a broomstick. You know, that's what you think. That's not what the Torah is talking about. And I say the idea of magic, so you're thinking of like a Houdini. Like we have different ways we think about these terms in English. The Hebrew term is... Well, so let's discuss it. Let's talk about kishuf. You know, so the idea of kishuf in the Torah, it's a very interesting concept, something which we don't really connect with these days. According to most opinions, it's not just a sleight of hand like modern-day magicians do. It's actually a real thing, intervening with forces in the world. There are those opinions which say that even the Torah discussion of kishuf is some sort of illusion or sleight of hand type activity. But according to most opinions, an accepted opinion is that there is something in reality called magic, which the Torah forbids. But it's possible. A person can do real magic and mess with the forces of nature and science, etc. The Torah forbids this, you know, in a very severe manner. Someone who performs this type of magic is put to death, executed. It's a capital offense. And I'm going to try to, again, I don't have a full understanding of it either myself. I'll try to give some sort of picture of what the Torah means by this. Just as an introduction to this idea. There's a concept throughout the Torah, which is that through the passage of time, the spiritual forces of the world become weaker. You know, so if you go back 5,000 years ago, closer to the time of creation, you go back close to the time of the giving of the Torah, you go back to the earlier ages, there was a much more potent spiritual forces in the world, on both ends. So the people who were fulfilling God's will on a much higher spiritual level and the ability to tap into negative spiritual forces was also a much, you know, more widespread ability. You read about the magicians of Pharaoh, you know, turning their staffs into snakes. They were able to replicate the plague of blood. There was something happening there. And just like we had prophecy, and we saw there was much more open miracles, and when you read about the scholars of earlier times, they're at a much higher level than our current day scholars. So too, when it comes to the other side of the coin, using negative spiritual abilities is also something which is much more widespread and doable in those times. As time goes on, so the whole world becomes less spiritual, people are less spiritual, spiritual forces are less and less accessible, both, you know, for good and for evil. So there's no prophecy anymore. The ability to connect with God in that intense way and to have that level of Torah scholarship is no longer accessible to us in the same way as it was before. And on the other hand, these ideas of magic, this draw towards idolatry, all these different other forces you read about throughout the Torah and Tanakh are also no longer really on the scene. So you do find people here and there, you know, you read stories of people in India, you know, with different spiritual force, things like that. You do read accounts like that. They seem to be real. There are people who are able to still access some of these things, it seems. But overall, the forces are much, much weaker in our time than was the times of the Talmud, even before that. That's why the Talmud might discuss, you know, demons. The Talmud might discuss other forms of spiritual beings which we have no connection with. It's because they are more sensitive. The world was more sensitive to these things back then. So I would give that as an introduction to the topic. But not to think that it's something which is totally like heebie-jeebie. You know, it's the world is different now than it was 2,000 years ago, too.
Can you give an example of what Kichu? What's an example?
So give me a few minutes, so we'll talk about it more. So give me some time to explain. So let me just open with an analogy. You know, and what I'm saying is based on really the early commentaries of how they explain this whole concept. You know, let's say there's a computer program. So most of us, you know, don't know that much about computer programming. So, you know, we turn on the program, we push start, and we use the computer as we're supposed to. Some, you know, so those people who we would call those computer geeks, those people who really know about programming, people who know how to get into the insides of the computer and the program, so they can override parts of the program. You can say the program says this is an invalid entry, but if you know what you're doing, you have ways you can override the program's rules. So there's rules set for the program, there's ways to use the program. Somebody knows what they're doing, they're able to get around those. You know, people can hack computers, you can hack websites, you can get around security, you can rewrite the code, you have ways you can do that. So that's the analogy I would give. Because there's so much more behind the scenes. There's a computer program which you see, and that's what you're actually using on the computer. But there's so much thought and effort went into building the computer, building the program. There's code, I don't personally know exactly how everything in the computer works, but there's a lot to it. So we're only seeing the very surface level of the program. You know, we're typing on whatever we're doing with the program, we're using the very surface level. But there's so much behind it which causes what happens on the screen. And the world also, you know, God set up a world. There's a world of nature, there's a world of science, there's physics, there's biology, there's anatomy, there's everything in the world. It's all there. And that's something which God put in the world, and God has a desire. The world should function in this way. But there's a lot to that. There's a lot behind it. I mean, both, you know, I guess basically you go to Kabbalistic sources and discusses, you know, how everything comes from God down to this world. Everything starts with God. God is one. God is everything. And then there's, you know, there's different pipelines and channels and levels in which things kind of come down into our world. We see them as we see them in the physical appearance. So the fact that the laws of science and nature are X, Y, and Z, it's because, you know, God has created the world in that way, where everything comes down, you know, comes down the pipeline from God Himself, and expresses itself in this world in that way. And these are all, you know, very deep, you know, Kabbalistic concepts. But the just like the computer programmer, many times can override the program, and somebody who's very knowledgeable about computers can override the system. So somebody can figure out God's system, he can, as it were, kind of override that system. So God says, I desire that nature should function in this way, and that, you know, there should be gravity, nobody should float. But there are ways in which a person can override that and say, okay, but now I'm going to make somebody float. That's possible, based on Torah sources. And it's very similar. The commentaries compare it to, there's prohibition in the Torah of crossbreeding animals, of grafting trees, and the like. So according to the Torah, it's forbidden to crossbreed animals. According to the Torah, it's forbidden to create new fruits by grafting, you know, existing fruits. It's forbidden according to Torah. If it's done, by the way, you're allowed to eat the fruit, but you're not allowed to do it personally. If a non-Jew decides to create a new fruit, and you have a nectarine, I think, is the combination, right? Nectarine. So you're allowed to eat it. It's fine to eat, but you're not allowed to actually secrete that first nectarine, right? That would be forbidden for a Jew to do. And the reason that the early sources explain for that prohibition is because, again, God desires that the world should be in this way. We're not supposed to mess with God's world. God said the world should create peaches, and the world should create, was it apricots? What's the other?
Yeah, I think peaches apricots, and apricots, I think,
right?
And make trees, yeah.
God never said that I want trees to produce nectarines. So if you come and decide to make a nectarine, what you're doing, even though you have the physical capability of doing it, this is not what God said I want my world to be like. Somebody, we want to have a donkey and a horse, I think, but to make a mule, if you crossbreed donkey and horse, that's something that we shouldn't be doing, because that's not what God desired to have in his world. God created every single species as is. He doesn't want us to create new species. That's how many of the early commentaries explain those prohibitions of crossbreeding animals, grafting trees, etc. So then they extend it to this idea of kishuf, of magic. The Talmud tells us that the word kishuf actually relates to the word machish. The word machish is a word which means to, let's say, contradict or to go up against or weaken something else. And they say the idea is that what you're doing when you use kishuf, when you use this idea of magic, you're going up against God's will in this world. God says, I want the world to function in this manner, and you're now deciding that you want it to function in a different manner. So God put the ability in the world. First, whenever people have free choice, God gives us challenges, but God says this is forbidden to do. If somebody comes along and does this, so it could be they'll succeed, and they'll be able to override some law of nature, or law of science, make something happen which is not natural. But what they're doing is they are coming and they're overturning God's plan for the world. That's what they're doing.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
It just seems a little bit contrary, because on one hand with the bris, you're supposed to do that. That's a commitment, positive commitment to do that. But yet with this, you're not supposed to. So, like,
what are you seeing as a bris that would be magical?
It's not magical, but you're changing
what God's plan, right?
Yeah, and
how are you
so
changing God's plan?
Well, in essence, you're taking a perfect person and you're.
But that's a
constant.
I don't see that
that's
changing
Greek,
God's
that's
plan.
That's a Greek argument.
Yeah. But I think the friend's point is that God said the human being should be born in this manner, and now we're coming and we're altering the human being.
So no, but God said to do that.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the answer to the question.
That's what I said, that God said we can do that, but he said we can't do the tree stuff.
Right, so the answer to the question is that's what God said, it's not what God said. Well, why God made that distinction? That could be another discussion, I'm not really sure.
You don't have an answer?
Are there any other? Can you come up with any other examples like the Brit Miller?
No.
Yes.
Is that the only example?
Making bread. Bread. Eating bread. God gave us wheat, but we're supposed to change it, grind it, and make it, bake it into bread at certain times, and also bake it into masses. But we're supposed to all take the raw material, and God doesn't give us. We're supposed to put effort into making something complete.
Right. So Phil's alluding to the famous discussion between Rabbi Akiva and one of the Roman generals. I think it was Aeternus Rufus. There was a discussion that's quoted between Rabbi Akiva and a Roman general. I forgot which Roman general it was. And they asked him, so he said to him, why would you, if God is perfect, why would you come and defile God's rule? God created a human being perfect. So how come you come along and give a bris milah to this child? So Rabbi Akiva says, so what's better? Is bread better or is wheat better? So he says, bread's better. So he says, the point is, I don't remember the full discussion, but the point was that man is supposed to take what God created and man is supposed to now bring it to the next step and perfect it. That's man's job in this world. It could be that this is not looked at as perfection. I don't know. And this is bringing off into another discussion. It could be that in certain areas, God says, I want you to work and perfect these areas. Other areas, God says, these are perfect, don't mess with these. And God's giving us those guidelines in the Torah, which areas are perfect, which areas need perfection. Because you have to leave some room for the human being to accomplish as well. If everything is perfect, then we're born with nothing to do. God wants to leave us a realm of accomplishment. Yeah, but why different areas are yes or no, I'm not really sure. That's a good question. So that the world, the concept that comes from this is the world is best if it continues down the path that God set out for it. The consistent laws of nature are supposed to remain consistent. And if a human being comes and tries to overturn those laws, so then what they're doing, they're saying, God, I know better, I don't care about your plan. Whatever statement it is, it's not a good statement towards God. It's a rebellious statement. It's a statement that I know better than God in some way. The examples of Kishuf, which are discussed, I mean, you have examples in the Torah itself, such as the magicians of Egypt turning their staffs into snakes, reciprocal replicating blood. Even in the Talmud, you have ideas of people, you know, causing others to get sick, which probably conjures up in our minds more of those ladies with the pots and the broomsticks and everything else. But
and the warts on their nose.
Right, yeah, right. The Mishnah even gives an example of somebody able to harvest a field of squash through magic. So it could be used, I guess, in many ways. I don't know how. I don't know exactly how it works, but those are the examples given in the Talmud. The Mishnah talks about somebody could be collecting squash from a field through magic.
Like a golem?
Not even a golem. Somehow you say the words and cucumbers, I don't know, squash comes. Yeah, I don't know. Right, I don't know. I'm not really sure. And the Mishnah distinguishes between sleight of hand and illusion versus real magic. No, the Torah, according to most sources, doesn't prohibit illusions or sleight of hand like we see nowadays. But the Torah prohibits real magic. Now, there actually is a rabbinic prohibition on sleight of hand and illusions, but that's when it's not obvious. Like, if you're trying to actually pretend it's you're really, like, nowadays, if you see a show from whoever,
like David Copperfield,
you know that deep down it's an illusion. We know that. He's not trying, you know, even though he might say, yeah, magical, this and that, but we know it's an illusion. So that the Torah doesn't prohibit it if it's merely, and it's known as to be an illusion. If it's something which they're trying to portray as actual magic, the Torah doesn't prohibit that. So for instance, they have in Chem Mill during the winter, they have, Saturday nights, they have a special father-son learning program. And they brought in a magician as like a treat, like, you know, one time throughout the year. So the person who runs the program got up before the magic show and he told the kids, everyone should know this is merely an illusion. There's no real magic. You know, this is not, we turn to her, the Torah prohibits real magic. To make sure it was clear to the kids that this isn't real magic that's happening. Because if it portrays itself as real magic, that would actually be a rabbinic prohibition if it looks that way, even if it's not real magic. That's an interesting side point.
They have a single Imam of Amalkas in Kent Mill, in addition to the father and son learning programs.
Sounds like a good idea to me, too.
Okay.
Yeah, why not, right?
So that's the idea of magic, and it's considered a very serious prohibition in the Torah. I guess it's not all that relevant to us these days. It's not common at all. Most of us don't really have any clue how, what, where, when, why. But the lesson that I would learn from it is to understand that the way God creates the world is the way the world should continue on. And we shouldn't think we know better. We can change the world. We can mess with the world. We're not supposed to mess with God's world in that way. To understand that Hashem's, to trust that Hashem set up everything in its ideal form, we should not try to override Hashem's plans. We just, within our framework that He gave us, we're supposed to function and act and produce. That's, I think, the message of the mitzvah.
This reminds me of a modern example of somebody has these mental powers. Somebody named Israeli named Uri Geller. Have you ever heard of Uri Geller? Yeah, he could concentrate on a spoon or a key and actually make it bend.
Wow.
Yeah. You ever heard of Uri Geller?
Yeah.
This is around 10 years ago. Uh-huh. He moved away from Israel because the people were, he couldn't live there because people would like make fun of him or whatever.
Interesting.
He was subject to a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's any questions about this topic?
The only thing I'd go with is where we can go back to the weather discussion we had earlier, and we studied the weather very carefully.
Right.
Hurricane hunters are up. Storm chasers are running around. We try to figure out how and why Derech came through, you know, with its wind and all that. And then there's the clouds, seeders, the ones who seed the clouds to get rain, or whatever. Would that then be considered going with the magic aspect because they're trying to change what God created as a cloud?
Right. But they're still working within nature, though. I mean, to take that scientific knowledge we have and use it, that's something that we're encouraged to do in those situations. The fact that we're able to, say, create a computer. So what we've done, God didn't create a computer. There's no computer which came down when God created the world. But God put in the world all the science needed to create a computer. And the human mind's able to figure all that out and put everything together and create that computer. And that's something we're supposed to do. to use what we know about science and allow it to help us succeed in the world and accomplish. That's something that's within the framework God set up. This is kind of going beyond that framework. This is saying I'm gonna override the laws of science, the laws of nature. Seeding a cloud is within the laws of science and nature. They're trying to use their scientific knowledge they have, you know, to create more rain, I guess. But I think that's the big difference. Are you going out of the box or staying in the box? That's all in the box. To magic is going out of the box. We're taking something which is not physical, it's not part of the laws of science or nature or physics or anything else, and we're trying to still override that somehow. I think that's the distinction.